Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Roseanne O. from Costa Mesa.
Good evening. My name is Roseanne, and I'm an alcoholic. And my last name is actually St. Ange. Everybody forgets the saint. Don't you see the halo? Anyway, I just want to first thank Mike for asking me to come here and speak. It is an absolute honor and a privilege. So thank you very much for asking me. Tonight I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like before I got sober, how I got sober, and how I've been able to stay here. I always like to start with the statistics, so you guys don't have to think about it all through my talk. And I do this because my sponsor does this, so I do what my sponsor does. I am 55 years old. I'll be 56 in November. I got sober when I was 29 years old. My sobriety date is March 1, 1987, and by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not taken a drink since that time. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. That means I have 26 years of sobriety. And I have a sponsor. Her name is Willa. She has 38 years of sobriety. And Willa has a sponsor. Her name is Betty. And Betty has 41 years of sobriety. I sponsor women, and they sponsor women. And so we carry it along. I have a home group. It's the Saturday morning Canyon Club 7 a.m. meeting down. It's a 7 a.m. meeting at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. And I've been going to that meeting regularly. It has been my home group for about the last 24 years of my sobriety. And so I'm very grateful to be here tonight. And basically, I grew up in a family that I have two older brothers, an older sister, and a younger half-sister. My father was always a practicing alcoholic the majority of my life. And my mother, I just wish she would have been, because it would have been, there would have been hope for her, but because she's a little nuts. But anyway, my parents got divorced when I was 6 months old, and each of them were married four times each. So I always like to say we had a lot of parents running around our household. It's very interesting. We moved a lot. And when I was about 11 years old, my mom decided that she was going to move us up to Lake Tahoe because my uncle owned a motel up there and she wanted to manage it. And she thought that my brothers would stop getting into trouble. And what I learned about doing that is wherever you go, there you are. And because you will get in trouble wherever you take yourself. And when I lived up in Lake Tahoe, I went to intermediate school and high school up there, and graduated from Incline Village High School, and had a lot of fun in my high school years. I can tell you that the first time I drank, I can't remember the exact day. I can definitely remember the feeling, but I can tell you it was somewhere around the age of 13, because I was the youngest of four. And so what happened was, I had this feeling the first time I drank that just, I felt better then, I felt prettier, I could do things and say things that I would not ordinarily do, and it was great. The only problem that I had was that it seemed that every time I drank, I always drank one drink too much. Ended up puking in somebody's car, and you know, I would have blackouts, I would say things that I didn't remember saying, and I would just experience that incomprehensible demoralization that we experience. And when I graduated from high school, I moved down to Southern California, and my dad asked me to work with him, and so I did. And I didn't like it after a while because it was just him and I in the office. He was an accountant. And so I decided to get a job at an insurance brokerage firm, and I was in the accounting department, and when I was there, I met him, and he was a great guy, and he drank like I drank. He had parents that both died as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism. He didn't want to be an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. So we dated for about 4.5 years. And one of the things that we did, because we didn't want to be alcoholic, is we decided that we would not drink 1 month out of the year. So we chose the month of February. Shortest month of the year. And we always have to take a break, though, in, you know, because I was a celebratory drinker. There's always a reason to party. And so Valentine's Day, you know, middle of the month, gotta celebrate. And so we would kind of take a break. And that's just what we did. And we didn't do anything that didn't include alcohol. That was just the way it was. And after about 4.5 years of this, you know, we were kind of volatile drinkers together, particularly. And so I did what anybody does when they be an alcoholic, practicing daily blackout drinker, and I married him. And so we got married, and I thought everything was going to be great. And when we were married about, a few months into the marriage, I guess one night I was really upset. I couldn't tell you what it was because I was in the middle of a blackout. I don't know if any of you have ever come out of a blackout in the middle of it. It's a very interesting experience. And but I was mad about something. And evidently, I went to go hit him like this, and he blocked me with his arm. And when he blocked me with his arm, I broke this hand in 5 places. And he left and went to go drink at a bar. And I called one of his friends and asked him to take me down to the hospital. So he did. He took me down to Hogue because I was way too drunk to drive. And I was really embarrassed that I had, you know, broken my hand when, you know, because I hit my husband. I mean, you just don't do those kinds of things. And so they asked me when I got to the hospital what I did. And I said, well, the cupboard door was open in the kitchen, and I turned around really fast, and I hit it. You know, I hit the cupboard, and I guess that's when it broke. And the doctor looked at me and said, really, it looks just like a fighter's break. And I can't get away with anything. So I had to go through surgery to have them, insert 5 pins. And then a few weeks later, I had to go back to surgery and have them take out the 5 pins. And then I got to go through about 12 weeks of occupational therapy to teach my pinky how to move. Now I can tell you when it's going to rain. And that's the kind of drinker that I am. Because I drink for oblivion. And I'm a blackout drinker, like I said. I was a daily drinker. And that's just the way I drink. And I couldn't stop. And when we had been married about 8 months, I ended up pregnant. I was shocked. And because I was told I could never have children, and then all of a sudden I'm pregnant. So I decided to go to my husband and tell him, you know, since I'm pregnant, I said, since we're pregnant, why don't we not drink for 9 months? And he looked at me and said, you're pregnant, I'm not, you quit. So I said, okay, well, my dad's wife, number 4, great gal, she's been in Al-Anon for about 44 years, I believe. But back then, she had been in Al-Anon for about, 15, 20 years. And she kept on telling me that I should go to Al-Anon because of my dad. And I really thought I should go to Al-Anon because of my husband. He had the problem. It wasn't me. And so on Friday night, I found this meeting in Irvine. I lived in Irvine. And at University in Culver, they had this Friday night meeting. And I would go in every week, and I would sit down, and I would listen, and then I'd get up, and I would leave every Friday night. I didn't raise my hand. I didn't share. I didn't participate. And that was my doing, not them. But the really interesting thing was, every Friday night, there was all this partying going on next door, hooting and hollering, man, they were having a blast. And finally, after about a month and a half, I think it was, I turned to the gal next to me and I said, "What is going on in that room?" And she looked at me very seriously and she said, "Oh, those are the alcoholics. They always have fun." Filed it away, went on my merry way, gave birth to a very healthy baby boy. And, you know, I started reading this book about mothers nursing their children, and it said that one beer a day is very good for mother's milk, unless you're an alcoholic. And so I started drinking one beer a day, and what I realized was you cannot drink just one beer a day. Okay, I cannot drink just one beer a day. I don't care about anybody else. And so I had to make that decision, and that decision was I had to either continue drinking and stop nursing, or continue nursing and stop drinking. So I chose to continue drinking and stop nursing, because that's what I had to do. And when my son was about 2 years old, some things happened with my husband that it was finally that light, that moment of clarity, where I thought, if I stay in this marriage, if I stay in this house, I not only am I going to die, my little son's going to die. And that scared me. I didn't care as much about me as I did my 2-year-old son. And so I went down to the bank, cut our savings account in half, took my half, went and rented an apartment, a little 2-bedroom apartment in Irvine. And I realized after about 3 weeks of being in this apartment that I was going through the same amount of bottles of wine. I was having the same blackouts. The only difference was I was the only one there to take care of my son, and it scared me to death. And I went through all the incomprehensible, demoralizing things that we do when we be alcoholic. And one Saturday morning, it was February 28th, 1987, I am sitting at my table in my dining room, and I'm going through the Irvine World News, and I'd never seen this before, but it was a listing of all the hotline numbers, the suicide prevention hotline and the rape crisis hotline and, you know, all these different hotline numbers. And at the very bottom, it said Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remembered that meeting on Friday nights. And so I picked up the phone and I called the number, and it was, they answered it, central office. And I said, "Do they still have that meeting on Friday nights at University in Culver?" And the lady said, "Yes, they do." And I said, "Great, can you tell me what time that meeting starts?" And she said, 8 p.m. And I said, "Thank you very much," and I hung up the phone. It did not dawn on me for a moment to ask if there were any other meetings during the week. I didn't know there were 1,000 meetings a week in Orange County. So I white-knuckled it from Saturday until the following Friday. And the first day that I did not have a drink was Sunday, March 1st, 1987. And I remember saying, "God, please help me just to get to that meeting. Something told me that if I could just get to that meeting on Friday night, I would be okay." And so I got a babysitter for my son, and I went over to the meeting, and there was a guy standing outside, and I swear this guy had a smile from ear to ear. And I walked up and I said, "Hi," and he goes, "Ha, how are you?" And I burst out in tears, and I said, "Is this Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Is this your first time?" And I said, "Yes, ever." And he said, "Hold on." And he goes running inside, and he comes back out, and he has two women with him. And one had 8 years and one had 18. And what I learned from that experience was that the women stick with the women and the men stick with the men. And they told me that I never had to drink again if I didn't want to. And they told me I never had to be alone again if I didn't want to. It was totally up to me. And they both gave me their phone numbers. And every time I raised my hand for the first 30 days and said, "My name is Roseanne, and I'm an alcoholic," I cried. Part of it was because I was scared to death, and I had no idea what I was in for. The other part of me was crying with joy because I knew for the first time I had hope. And so this gal came up to me after the meeting, and she told me about the meeting after the meeting and how important the meeting after the meeting is, and because that's when you really get to know people. And everybody goes to Coco's after the meeting, and we have pie and coffee. And I'm like, okay, great. And so then she said to me, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No," I said, "can you tell me about the sponsorship thing? Because I don't really understand it." And she said, "Sure." She said, "There's a pamphlet in the back, and it's called Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. I suggest you read that pamphlet from cover to cover. Always read with a highlighter, and highlight anything that jumps out at you." And I thought, okay. And then she told me some very important things. She said, "It's very important to remember that a sponsor is a guide to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are not a god of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They guide you through the 12 steps. They introduce you to the meetings that they go to. They introduce you to the people that they hang with. And they just share their experience, strength, and hope. They are not your banker. They are not your babysitter. They are not your counselor. They simply share experience, strength, and hope." And she told me that the reason that Alcoholics Anonymous works is because there is a singleness of purpose. And the singleness of purpose is to achieve sobriety, to stay sober, and to help others to achieve sobriety. And that was working for me. And then she told me some very important things. She said that whenever you get a sponsor, you should make sure that they have at least 1 year of sobriety, so that they've gone through an entire year, and that they have worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous all the way through at least once. So I turned to her and I said, "Well, how long have you been sober?" And she said, 8.5 years. And I said, "Oh, that's great. Have you ever worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?" She assured me that she had. Now, she had also told me that she had asked her first sponsor to be a temporary sponsor because she didn't know if she was going to like her. And I'm thinking, oh, that's good, because I don't know if I'm going to like this one, you know. I don't know. So I asked her if she would be my temporary sponsor, and she said yes. Now, she did not tell me to call her every day. I called her every day because everything was a big deal. Everything. It was so dramatic. So I was calling her up, and you know, we're going through all the drama, and she keeps bringing me back to the steps. And she said to me, she said, "Roseanne, I'd like you to do something." She said, "I'd like you to write a list of 30 things that you're powerless over and 3 things that are unmanageable in your life." And I start writing a list. And what I realized from writing that list is, see, I thought I had power over certain things, and what I realized is I have power over nothing. I have power over my attitude, but even with my attitude, I need to ask God to redirect my thinking, because I can get in such a place that I'm spinning out of control. And so I asked God to redirect my thinking. And unmanageability, trust me, I had it all over the place. And then she told me that I was to start reading the big book, but that I did not have to start on page 1. And I thought, wow, this is special, man. I must be really good. I'm advanced. No, she said, "You are going to start at the table of contents. You're first going to read the table of contents, and then I'd like you to read the first foreword, the second foreword, the third foreword, the doctor's opinion, and the real story. And when you're at the end of that, that's all of step 1. And always read with a highlighter," she said. And so I would. And then she told me when I was done reading out of the big book that I'm to go to the 12 and 12, and I'm to read step 1 out of the 12 and 12. And when I'm done reading both of those, I'm to write on a piece of paper what step 1 means to me. She said it didn't matter if it was a sentence, a paragraph, 10 pages. She didn't care. She just wanted me to put down on paper what I believed step 1 was about and what it meant to me. And that's exactly what I did. And then I had to do the same thing with step two. And I will also tell you that that book, Living Sober, that Marcia talked about, that book saved my life in the beginning of my sobriety. Because, see, I was a single mom of a two-year-old, and I did not have the privilege of going to a meeting whenever I wanted. I had to schedule my meetings. I had to fit them in accordingly. And she told me that I was going to have to work the program harder than most people do. I was going to have to pick up that 5,000-pound telephone and call people more than most people do, because I could not go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I had to really work the program. And that book, Living Sober, absolutely helped me tremendously. And I learned to reach out. So then she had me do step two. And what I realized after reading step two out of the big book and step two out of the 12 and 12 is that if I continue doing the same behavior and I expect different results, I will be totally insane. But if I change my behavior even slightly, the results will change. That means not the big stuff. The big stuff's easy. It's the little stuff. Like every day, I had to make my bed so that when I got home, I liked being in my apartment because it looked neat and clean when I walked in the door. Those are the things that I learned to do, the little things. When it came to step three, I read out of the big book, I read out of the 12 and 12, and I never had a problem with God beforehand. What I learned is that there's religiosity and there's spirituality. It's possible for them to live together. And some people, because of the relationship that they've had with God in the past, it kind of throws them off. What I truly believe is that Dr. Bob and Bill W. made God user-friendly. And I'm so grateful for that, because God delivered me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous delivered me back to God. And the one thing that I absolutely love is that third step prayer, where it says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. And I will tell you, my favorite part is relieve me of the bondage of self, because I can get, I don't care how much time a person has sober, I can still get so wrapped up in myself. And I have to remember, it's not all about me. And then we get to the fourth step. And I wasn't around long enough to know that there is, you know, I later on heard people go, oh, the fourth step. Well, the fourth step is not that bad. But I read it and I didn't understand it. And so I told my sponsor, and she said, read it again. So I read it again. Went back to her. I said, I don't understand it. She said, read it again. I read it again. She said, just do it. So that's what I did. You know, and I learned that there are, a lot of people forget that there's other parts. It's not just the negative. It's not just the resentments that we write down. It's the good stuff, too. When we take an inventory, it's what we have and what we don't have. So that's what I was directed to do. And then I had to make the four columns. Very simple. Who was it? What happened? How did it make me feel? And then the last column, what's my part? Now, the what's my part, I had a little trouble getting that one. And so my sponsor told me that that's okay. I didn't have to put what my part was if I couldn't figure it out. That we would talk about it when we did the fifth step. Yes, we would. I realized now why we do a fourth step and why we do a fifth step. Because I sat with her, and this is again after reading and writing on the fourth, reading and writing on the fifth, and then sitting with my sponsor and reading my fourth step to her. You see, I can pick out every one of your character defects. I just cannot pick out mine. It's just one of those issues. But my sponsor can be objective, and she can tell me, she can articulate what my character defects are. And so here we are at the sixth step, and I'm thinking, nanosecond step. It is the shortest. It's the shortest paragraph in the big book. I mean, it's one paragraph. That's it. Step six, one paragraph. And it's the shortest chapter in the 12 and 12. So I read that, and I'm thinking, you can get through this pretty quick. You know, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You just have to know what they are. And so what my sponsor had me do, and what I do with the girls that I sponsor now is a little bit different, is take 3x5 cards, and we have to agree on what the character defects are. So, and that's what my sponsor had me do that too, where let's say one of my character defects was dishonesty and honesty. Well, it was dishonesty. So on a card, 3x5 card, I would put dishonesty and honesty. Take all of my character defects, turn them upside down, shuffle them up, and ask God, okay, God, just for today, which character defect would you like me to work on? And I'd pick up the one card, and just for that day, just one, because remember, this is one day at a time, and I can do anything by a one. You give me all my character defects, I'm either going to commit homicide or suicide. And but one character defect I can handle. So I'd pick it, I'd look at it, okay, dishonesty and honesty. So I'd ask God, okay, could you please show me where I'm dishonest today, and please show me where I'm honest. And I'd go throughout the day. And you know what I learned from that? At the end of the day, I'd go back through and I'd look at my day and I'd say, okay, God, please show me, please let me see where I was honest and where I was dishonest. And what I found was I was very cash register honest. It was the honesty to me that I was lying. You know, I was lying to myself about all kinds of things. And so I got to see one day at a time what my character defects. And it took me about 9 months to work that sixth step. And I could not get through all of that sixth step until I learned what my character defects were. Because how can you become entirely ready to have them removed if you don't know what they are, if you don't understand them? And then the seventh step, I love the seventh step. It's the step of humility, where we ask God. And in the original manuscript of the 12 steps of the big book, actually, it originally read, humbly on our knees, ask God to remove our shortcomings. That step is all about humility. And I'm going to share with you what has recently happened to me that has brought... See, the opposite of humility is pride. And that step seven is so in my face right now because of the pride issue. More people, in fact, everybody that I've ever talked to that has gone out and drank and then had the fortune to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, the one common thread that I have seen that why they go out is pride. You see, everybody becomes an idiot at the meeting, and why do I have to listen to her again? And no, I'm not going to tell him anything, and you know, I'm not going to do this, and I'm not going to do that. And we look for the differences, not the similarities. Pride pops up in a lot of different ways. Well, I have this sister who's 15 months older than me, and she wronged me. So for 13 years, I did not speak to her. And she lived in Maui for, she actually lived there for 36 years. And in June, I went on vacation to Kauai, different island. But I started getting this nudge. It's the God nudge. And the God nudge was saying, call Shirley up and tell her you just want to let bygones be bygones. And I'm like, really? Okay. So I'm in Hawaii and I pick up the phone and I call her up June 16th, 2013. And I said, Shirley, this is Roseanne. I know we haven't spoken in 13 years. But I just like bygone. I'd like us to just let bygones be bygones, put the past behind us. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to rehash anything. I just want to move forward. She started crying. She said, that's all I've ever wanted. I said, okay. So we started talking every week, sometimes two, three times a week. because she was sick, she had lupus and she had throat cancer, and she had had some radiation therapy. She needed some help from my mom, so she was moving back to Lake Tahoe on July 6th, which she did. And we were talking, and it was just really fun. You know, it was fun to have a sister again after all those years. And her birthday was August 9th. And on August 9th, 2013, she turned 57 years old. And I called her up, and we had a great conversation, and she was laughing, and she was telling me she had hope. And, you know, it was just really a cool thing. And I did not know that on August 14th, 2013, she would be murdered. And she was. And I will tell you that I absolutely have no regrets, because I was reconciled with her. And what I know, what I learned in this program, is that when we get that God nudge, it's important to follow that God nudge, because you don't even know what is going to happen. The way I found out was not from my mom, but I found out from my little sister, who I hadn't talked to in 15 years. Such a communicative family. And she had done some things. I didn't talk to her. And she tells me that my sister had been murdered. And it just kind of flew out of my mouth. And I just said, you know, we haven't spoken in 15 years. I'd like us just to let bygones be bygones. Let's not rehash the past. Let's just move forward. She said, okay. So now we talk all the time. And it's a nice relationship. And, you know, I keep learning in this program, because you see, that pride could keep me from having a relationship and mending all of that. And then I wouldn't have had that closure. You see, my little sister, she's having a tough time because she wasn't reconciled with my sister. They hadn't been talking, and she's going through a tough time. I'm so grateful that not only did I get the God nudge, but that I responded to the God nudge. And, you know, I have this little saying at home that says, Lord, please put your arm around my shoulder and your hand over my mouth. Because that's what I need sometimes. You know, because it was their fault. They did it to me. But it doesn't matter who did it to who. And I have her ashes at home, and I'm going to be taking them to Maui in March, and we're going to scatter her ashes, my little sister and I. So, you know, good things happen. God makes good things happen out of bad things. Continuing on with the steps, step 8, it says we made a list of those that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. And that's all I had to do. I learned to pray for the willingness to be willing to be willing to be willing to be willing. Then you get the willingness, because all you need is that mustard seed of willingness and you can get it. So I just had to make the list. And then step 9 is when we actually make the amends. And more women that I have sponsored have gone out in during that step than any other step. Again, it's the pride, because we just don't want to tell anybody that we're sorry. We just don't want to admit anything. And what I learned is, it's not about rehashing. In fact, rehashing will make it worse, almost guaranteed every time. It's about making an amends for the wrongs you did. But you don't have to go through every little item in there. This is just my experience. And everything I say up at this podium, everything you hear tonight, is simply my personal experience, strength, and hope. Because all of us have opinions, but if you ever want the truth, just go to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there it will be. And what I learned about the 9th step after doing the reading and the writing and making my amends is that there are 2 parts to that step, and a lot of people miss that. The first part is to make your amends, to acknowledge that you've wronged. The second part is to change your behavior. And if you haven't changed it, you haven't done the step. Because you're just doing the same thing and expecting different results. And you'll always get what you always got if you always do what you always did. And step 10, I love, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Absolutely, I try to do that on a daily basis. Sometimes I don't realize on that day that I did something wrong, but I will go back and make amends as soon as I do. I will change my behavior. I fess up. Step 11 is my favorite step. It's the step, you know, I was raised Jewish. I was bat mitzvahed the whole bit. I had a great God when I was growing up. Nothing wrong with God, you know. I mean, kind of damning, but hey, it's okay. And this is just my personal experience. And I will tell you that this is when I learned about a relationship with God, because that's what I learned. By doing step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out, this is what I found. He wants a relationship with me. That's when I became a Christian. That's when I saw who the real God is, and that's when my entire life changed, and it changed for the better. Because I have such a wonderful relationship with Him. You see, I feel like there's a bungee cord. One end is tied to God and the other end is tied to me. And He's never dropped me so far that I've broken my neck and died. And even if He did, I'd be okay. I'd be in a better place. Step 12, I continue to practice these principles in all of my affairs, not just in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but in all of my affairs, with my family, at work, with my friends, in Alcoholics Anonymous, at church, wherever I am. I learn to practice these principles in all of my affairs, and I work with others. And I probably go to more meetings per week now than I ever did in the beginning of my sobriety, because like I said, those first 20 years, I had kids. I couldn't go to a meeting every day. I had to pick and choose my meetings carefully. Now I probably go 5 meetings a week. And I love going to meetings because I can never give back to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous what it has so freely given me. And so some of the things that happened when I had a year of sobriety, my husband caught the disease of alcoholism. And he went and got sober. And so we decided that we would try and date. Well, we decided that we were better off divorced than we were married. But we remained friends. And because my sponsor told me that if I was to say anything to him that wasn't right, I was going to have to make an amends. And I'll tell you what, I didn't want to do that. So I watched my mouth. And we really did remain friends. And we had a good relationship. And when I was about 3 years sober, I met a guy in the program. I was speaking at a meeting down in Newport Beach. He was taking his 1 year cake. I did not 13 step him. He was celebrating his first year. Okay, so we start, some friends introduced us that I knew in the program, and they knew him, and we started dating, and love on AA campus. And so we got married on our 1 year anniversary, which was his 2 year AA birthday. And we ended up getting pregnant on the honeymoon. And so here I was with another baby on the way. And just before we got married, I found out that I had another disease. You heard about it earlier tonight. And that's the disease of hepatitis C. And they told me that I had a chance if I got on these medications. This is back in the 1990s, so they had just developed all the tests and everything. But they told me that I could try this experimental drug, interferon. So I did, and it didn't work. And so then I tried it again, and it still didn't work. And anyway, I went ahead and I had my son and had my second son, and everything was going along just fine. And but right after I had him, there was another thing that we found, was that in my leg there was this pulse, and they couldn't figure out what it was. And ultimately what it was cancer in my leg, a very rare form of cancer. And one doctor wanted to amputate my leg, and another one said, no, leave it in. And another one said, no, we need to take out the, you know, the cancer. And I was confused. And I will tell you what, that is the time that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked me. because everything that I'd put in those previous years was like the bank. And women would bring meals, and they'd come over and clean the house, and the cards that I got are part of my gratitude list today. And I just felt so loved. And here I have this little six-week-old baby, and I find out that I have cancer, and it was a little tenuous then. And then after, once we got through the cancer thing, I had to go on another treatment for the hepatitis C, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I can do this. And I'm like, God, really? And but I did, because it's one step at a time. They teach me what to do, and I do it, man. I learned to take direction here. And so what happened was, by the way, I am in remission from the cancer. I've been in remission for 19 and a half years. I have also been in remission from the hepatitis C for the last 12 years. I think it's 12 years. And so I'm very, very grateful for that, because I learned how to take direction here. And so the other thing that happened was my husband decided he was going to go on a mission trip to Haiti for 10 days. That means you can't reach him or anything. Well, during that time, I got a call, and this is again where God just is right there for you. I walked in the house. It was April 14th, 1997. My older son was 12. My younger son was 5. And the phone was ringing when I walked in the door. And the God thing was that, you see, my 12-year-old son and I picked up the phone at the same time. But when he heard that I got the call, he hung it up. That was the God thing. Because what happened was this. On the other end of the line was a police officer with the Irvine Police Department. And they asked me, if I was who I was. And they said, ma'am, we need you to come down to the Irvine Medical Center. We need you to identify the body of, and they named my first husband. And I said, is he alive? And they said, no, ma'am, he is not. Now, I said, I'll be right down. I hung up the phone. I called a babysitter. My sponsor was never home after work. She always went to the gym. But this particular night, you see, God will make sure that my sponsor is there every time I need her. Not necessarily when I want her, but always when I need her. So I picked up the cell phone. That's a time when they were like this big. And picked up the cell phone, and I called her, and I said, I just got a call from the police department. I have to go identify the body, Jim's body. And she said, oh my gosh, I'll meet you there. And she did. And when I got down, I don't know if any of you have ever seen anybody who has died as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism, but I can tell you that I have. And this is what happens, you see, because after a year and a half of him being in the program, being sober, everybody became an idiot. And he wasn't going to listen to anybody, and he wasn't going to tell this person that, and this person this, and he was tired of listening to all the stuff people had to say. He was looking at the differences, not the similarities. And when I looked at his body, it was so yellow. And what happens when you die as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism is that you, your body, your insides start to give out. They start to shut down. And so he first had his esophagus burst and a few other really horrible things. And then he died from cirrhosis from the liver. And then everything else started giving out. And then he died. And I had to identify his body. And when I got home, I had the duty of going to my 12-year-old son and telling him that his father had just died as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism. And I will tell you this, the sound that came from my son, was like the sound of a wounded animal in the wild. I hope I never, ever forget that sound, because that's where my drinking could take me. I don't know why I stay around, but I'll tell you this. I keep doing all the things that I did in the very beginning of my sobriety, because I don't know what one thing it is that I'm doing is going to be the one thing, if I stop doing it, is the one thing that's been keeping me sober. And so I do the things that I've always done, and I'm so grateful for that. And that son is now 29 years old, and he's a great kid, and we have a great relationship. And my other son, Chris, my older son's Tyler, the younger son is Chris. He's 21 now. When he was 14, I had to send him to a ranch in Utah. And the reason is because his dad decided that he was going to he didn't want to stay sober anymore. And he was going out, and I kept on trying to stay in the marriage, but after about 8 years, I couldn't do it anymore. And so I finally told him I could not live in a non-sober relationship. And so we got a divorce. And that was really hard for me, because I didn't want to get a divorce. I didn't want to be like my parents, you know. And but we got the divorce, and my then 14-year-old spiraled out of control. And he went to a ranch in Utah for 14 months, and then he came back, and he stayed sober, and then he didn't, and then he stayed sober, and he didn't. And I finally said, nothing else I can do. And then he stayed sober. But then he went out. So he's out, but it's okay. I always pray for him. And I have a great relationship with him today as well, and with both of my sons. I went back to school when I was 50 years old. And I got a 3.85 GPA at UCI. That's what I'm talking about. I never got a 3.85 GPA ever in my life before. But it's because you guys taught me how to do things one at a time. And that's what I did. And now I'm a paralegal. I'm a litigation paralegal. And I love my job. I love court. I know you all may not, but I love it. It's my job. I have a passion for it. And, you know, I'm so grateful for the life that I have today. I really am. It's the last thing that I really want to share is this, that it's an Indian proverb that really sums up how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always like to share this at the end of every meeting that I share at. And it goes like this. If you meet a man and he's hungry, give him a fish. He can eat for one day. But if you teach him how to fish, he can eat for the rest of his life. That is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.